saying that in late June. In 1980, when Ronald Reagan was elected as president, he declared, and those administrations proclaimed, a desire to radically change the direction of constitutional law and to dramatically change the composition of the Supreme Court and the federal courts. They planned an agenda to change the law with regard to almost every major area of constitutional law, and they wanted to do so by putting under the Supreme Court and the lower federal courts solid right-wing conservatives. I think to understand what's occurred during the Bush administration, you must see it as a continuation of the right-wing revolution that began with Ronald Reagan. I would suggest to you this afternoon that the Bush administration has set out to carry forth that agenda with truly radical, dramatic, incremental changes in the law. What I'd like to do is go area by area and show you how the Bush administration has advocated this. And the reason they're likely to succeed in some of these areas is because the justices that President Reagan, the first President Bush, and this President Bush put on the Supreme Court. Without a doubt, when we talk about the long-term significance of the Bush administration for the Constitution and the Supreme Court, it's the justices who they've appointed. The reality is, John Roberts is ideologically the same as William Rehnquist. I've yet to be able to identify many instances where Roberts voted differently than the way the justice he clerked for, William Rehnquist, would have voted. But Samuel Alito, much different than the justice he replaced, Sandra Day O'Connor. And replacing O'Connor with Alito is going to make an enormous difference, not only this year and next year, but for a long time to come. Let me pick a number of areas to show you where what began with the Reagan presidency is continuing and now coming to fruition with Bush and the Roberts Court. Let me take these areas alphabetically, which means the one I start with is abortion rights. There's no doubt that the Reagan administration sought out to overturn Roe v. Wade. In fact, in 1992, the Bush administration filed a brief in the Supreme Court, written primarily by the then Deputy Solicitor General, John G. Roberts, urging the Supreme Court to overrule Roe v. Wade. But there were only four votes on the court that year to overrule Roe v. Wade. Only Chief Justice Rehnquist, Justice White, and Justice Scalia, and Justice Thomas. They didn't have the fifth vote to overrule Roe. But slowly the Supreme Court has chipped away at Roe, and just last April, not quite a year ago, the Supreme Court indicated that it's likely to uphold almost any government law regulating abortion up to the point of a complete overruling of Roe v. Wade, laws that completely ban abortion. To put this in some context, in 1992, in the case I mentioned, Planned Parenthood versus Casey, the Supreme Court said that a law regulating abortion will be declared unconstitutional if it is an undue burden on the right to abortion for some women. You might remember, if you're familiar with the law in this area, that part of the Pennsylvania statute that was issued there said that before a married woman could obtain an abortion, she had to give notice to her husband. The Supreme Court declared that unconstitutional. And the key joint opinion of Justice O'Connor, Kennedy, and Souter said, some married women are in abusive relationships, and for them to notify their husbands would be an undue burden. The court said it doesn't matter how many women are in abusive relationships, because for those who are, it's an undue burden. The court followed this up in 2000 with a case called Stenberg versus Carhart. It involved a Nebraska law prohibiting so-called partial birth abortion. Now, there's actually no such medical procedure. This is a term coined by anti-abortion groups. The Nebraska law prohibited removal of a living fetus, a substantial part of a living fetus, with the intent of ending the fetus's life. The Supreme Court, 5-4, declared that law unconstitutional. Justice Breyer wrote to the court, joined by Justices Stevens, Souter, Ginsburg, and O'Connor. He said the law was unconstitutional because it had no health exception. Medical evidence showed for some women, especially women with certain medical disorders, in the weeks right before viability, this is the safest form of abortion. He also said that the law was not narrowly tailored. It didn't cover just one abortion procedure, but many. Justice O'Connor wrote a concurring opinion saying she needs to vote to uphold the law from a so-called partial birth abortion, so long as it's a health exception, and so long as it was merely written. The Bush administration strongly pushed Congress to pass the Federal Partial Birth Abortion Ban Act of 2003. The federal law prohibits partial birth abortion. It has no health exception, and though it's narrower than the Nebraska law struck down in Stenberg, it's certainly broader than what the Supreme Court said it would uphold. Last April 18th, in Gonzalez versus Carhart, the Supreme Court 5-4 upheld the federal statute. There's no way to distinguish the federal law from the one that was struck down in Stenberg, so you might wonder, what's the difference? What happened between 2000 when Stenberg was decided and 2007? The answer, of course, is that Justice Alito replaced Justice O'Connor. Because what happened was the other dissenters in Stenberg, Scalia, Kennedy, and Thomas, were joined by Roberts, taking the same position as William Rehnquist, and Justice Alito to create the majority. The Supreme Court changed both the law and the rhetoric of abortion. It's the law, Justice Kennedy's majority opinion said, that the federal statute is constitutional because it is not an undue burden for a large fraction of women. Remember, the test before was a law would be unconstitutional. It was an undue burden for some women. Now it's unconstitutional only if it's an undue burden for a large fraction of women. That's going to make it much harder to have laws regulating abortion to put unconstitutional. And the court changed the rhetoric of abortion. In several places in the majority opinion, Justice Kennedy referred to the fetus as, quote, the unborn child. At one point he said, there's no evidence to support this yet, but some women surely come to regret having had abortions, and for them, abortion is harmful to their self-esteem. Justice Ginsburg wrote a vehement dissent that she read from the bench. She said, under Roe v. Wade and Planned Parenthood v. Casey, it's for each woman to decide for herself what's in her physical and psychological best interest. It's not for the 5 men in the majority to decide what's good or bad for women's self-esteem. But the rhetoric is the language of the anti-abortion movement. And I think that with the most recent decision, Gonzalez versus Carhart signals is that this is a court that will uphold virtually any government regulation of abortion up to the point of a complete ban on abortion. I think most people in this room, unlike my students, remember the time when abortion was illegal. I remember when I was a freshman in college, a woman who lived on the same floor of my dorm, finding out that she was pregnant through something that could only be referred to today as date rape. And deciding, and this was 1971, that she didn't want to have that child. And I remember the terror that she expressed to me as a friend as she had to find, hopefully safe, but illegal abortion. We were at most one vote on the Supreme Court from those being the days again we are. And we're coming very close in terms of the kind of government regulations this court will allow. The second area that I want to talk about, going again alphabetically, concerns access to the courts. And my prediction for you, and it's a very frightening one to me as somebody who teaches courses about procedure, is I think the area where the Roberts Court is going to make the biggest change in the law is cutting off access to the courts, closing the courthouse door. Because one way to take away people's rights is keeping them from getting to court at all. And what the Bush administration has done over and again is support restrictions on access to the courts. Let me give you some examples from just the last year of the Supreme Court, some of which got media publicity, some of which didn't. First case I want to talk about is a case called Bowles versus Russell. And my guess is you haven't heard about it. A man in Ohio got convicted of second-degree murder, got sentenced to 15 to 25 years in prison. Went through the Ohio state system appealing his conviction, and he lost. He then filed a petition for habeas corpus in federal district court. It's his right to do so. The district court ruled against him. He then asked for an extension of time to file his notice of appeal so he'd go to the Federal Court of Appeals. The district court judge said he had 17 days to do this. He filed his notice of appeal on the 16th day. The state of Ohio argued to the Federal Court of Appeals this was untimely, but under the federal statute, the judge only had the authority to grant a 14-day extension. But he had a backup argument. There were Supreme Court decisions that said even untimely notices of appeal are allowed so long as they're extraordinary circumstances. What would be a more exceptional circumstance than the trial judge made a mistake? The Bush administration came down on the side of the state of Ohio, and in a 5-4 decision, so did the Supreme Court. Justice Thomas wrote the opinion, same five in the majority as in Gonzalez versus Carhart, who's joined by Chief Justice Roberts, Justice Scalia, Justice Kennedy, and Justice Alito. Justice Thomas said that the statute that says that notice of appeal can be extended 14 days is so-called jurisdictional in nature. What that means is courts can't grant an extension. There's so many federal laws and rules that create time limits. Almost never are they deemed jurisdictional in nature, so judges can't grant an extension. And as to the precedents that it said untimely notice of appeal are allowed in extraordinary circumstances, those were expressly overruled. So here's a man who did everything that the district court said, followed a lot of the Supreme Court precedents, and still will never be able to appeal the denial of the habeas corpus petition. Another case from last year that illustrates this, and again shows where the Bush administration is a case called Hine versus Freedom from Religion Foundation. This involves something that never makes headlines in newspapers. Who has standing to come to court to sue? Again, the reality is a court can keep rights from being vindicated just by making sure that no one would have standing to be able to sue. You might remember that one of the first things that President Bush did upon taking office was create an Office of Faith-Based Programs. This is designed to allow faith-based institutions, which is just a euphemism for churches, synagogues, mosques, to directly receive federal social service money. Previously, the law had been that if a church or a synagogue or a mosque wants federal social service money or state or local social service money, they have to create a secular arm. But the Bush position is in favor of what's sometimes called charitable choice, allowing the church, the synagogue, the mosque to directly get federal money to drug rehabilitation or alcohol rehabilitation or daycare or the like. A public interest group, Freedom from Religion Foundation, brought a lawsuit challenging it. The Supreme Court had previously said the one place where a taxpayer can come to court and is standing to sue is if the government expenditures are violating the Establishment Clause of the First Amendment. And that's what Freedom from Religion Foundation argued here, that the government was spending federal money to support churches, synagogues, mosques, and that's an impermissible establishment of religion. The Bush administration urged the Supreme Court to dismiss the case for lack of standing. It might be worth noting that the Federal Court of Appeals in Chicago, an opinion by not liberal judge Richard Posner, ruled that there was standing for this group. The Supreme Court 5-4 ruled in favor of the Bush administration. Here, Justice Alito wrote the opinion for the court, and the majority was comprised of the same five justices who were part of the other two cases that I mentioned. Justice Alito said, the earlier cases said that taxpayers have standing to challenge government expenditure of money as violating the Establishment Clause, but they were all expenditures pursuant to a specific federal statute. He said this is different because this is expenditures from general executive revenue, so there's no standing here. To me, that's a distinction that's impossible to defend. All the money comes from the same federal treasury. The president, acting Article 2 of the Constitution, has to comply with the First Amendment, as much as Congress, acting Article 1 of the Constitution, has to comply. In fact, even Justice Scalia and Thomas concurred in the judgment, said this is a meaningless distinction. They would have just overruled the earlier cases. But the Supreme Court said, even if the government is violating the Establishment Clause of the First Amendment, no one has standing to be able to sue. One more case about access to the courts, and again, this is a case that got a lot of media publicity. A case called Ledbetter versus Goodyear Tire and Rubber from last June. Lily Ledbetter worked for 19 years at Goodyear, almost all in a managerial position as an area supervisor. Near the end of her employment, she discovered that she was paid significantly less than male employees who were in the same position, received the same promotion, the same performance evaluation, and had been there about as long. And she sued. And a jury found in her favor, finding that she was being paid which the third class then nails to it. Oh, the other way, we're comparable. Goodyear goes to the Supreme Court, again with the Bush administration on its side, and says that her claims were barred by the statute of limitations. They said that the statute of limitations has to run from the time that her pay was set. And so whenever those pay decisions were made before. Now, Ledbetter had a really good argument, and with the Supreme Court decision behind her, saying each additional paycheck is a separate discriminatory act, and the statute of limitations can run from it. If she's right, then her claims are not time-barred. If she's wrong, then almost all of her claims are time-barred, because a lot of the pay was set a long time ago. The Supreme Court, in a 5-4 decision, sided with Goodyear and the Bush administration, saying that she was barred from bringing her claims. Justice Alito wrote for the court, same five justices in the majority. Justice Alito said, well, each additional paycheck is evidence of discrimination, but it's not a separate discriminatory act. As Justice Ginsburg pointed out, this is going to close the door to many victims of pay discrimination based on race and gender. Justice Ginsburg pointed out that a third of all employees in the private sector work in places where they are prohibited from discussing their salary with other employees. And even where there's not a formal prohibition, there's often a norm against discussing salary. As Jennifer pointed out, I taught at the University of Southern California for 21 years. I never knew what anybody else on the faculty got paid. We never discussed our salary with each other. I've been at Duke for 4 years. I know my wife is on the faculty gets paid, but I don't know anybody else gets paid. The reality is it's going to be very difficult for people to bring pay discrimination claims because of this. The Supreme Court has closed the courthouse door. The third area that I want to talk about concerns affirmative action. Again, I can trace the positions of the Bush administration and the Roberts Court back to briefs filed by the Reagan Justice Department. Strong opposition to any effort to use race or gender as a factor to alleviate tax discrimination to achieve diversity. And we saw this position come to fruition on June 28th of 2007 in a case called Parents Involved in Community Schools for Seattle School District No. 1. Seattle, Washington, and Louisville, Kentucky, each wanted to increase diversity in their schools. For Seattle, it was for the high schools. For Louisville, it was starting at kindergarten. And for each of these school districts, what they decided to do was to use race as one factor among many in assigning students to try to achieve more diversity. The Federal Court of Appeals on the West Coast, the Federal Court of Appeals in Kentucky, upheld these programs. The Supreme Court, 5-4, declared both unconstitutional. Chief Justice Roberts wrote in part for the court, and in part just for a plurality of four. Justice Kennedy didn't join all of his opinions. Chief Justice Roberts said, diversity in the classroom is not a compelling government interest. Achieving desegregation is not a compelling government interest. I cannot imagine the Supreme Court more turning its back on the legacy of Brown v. Board of Education than that opinion written by Chief Justice Roberts. Additionally, five justices in the majority, the same five in all the other cases that I mentioned, said that the government could use race at most as a factor if it showed no other alternative would achieve diversity, a burden that's very difficult to meet. I have so often heard conservatives proclaim that they're in favor of judicial restraint and judicial deference. Here what you have is promptly elected school boards in two places deciding that they want to enhance diversity using race as one factor. Where was the judicial deference by conservatives here? So often I've heard conservatives talk about we need to follow the original intent of the framers. I'm skeptical we'll ever know original intent of the framers. But if there's any place where it's clear that the framers of the 14th Amendment very much supported what today we would call affirmative action. But you don't find justices like Scalia and Thomas, advocates for originalism, invoking original intent in this area. I fear that there are now five votes on the Supreme Court to overturn the decision from June of 2003 in Grutter versus Bollinger. Grutter versus Bollinger is the case where the Supreme Court said that colleges and universities have compelling interest in diversity, and if college universities may use race as one factor in admissions decisions to achieve diversity. The decision in Grutter was written by Justice O'Connor, joined by Chief Justice Rehnquist, Justice Stephen sued Ginsburg and Breyer. Justice Alito has replaced Justice O'Connor. I think there's little doubt as to how he'll vote in this, given that he joined Chief Justice Roberts' opinion from parents involved in community schools. I've been a law professor for 28 years now. I've taught courses like constitutional law and criminal procedure in classes that are almost all white and classes with a significant number of minority students. It is a different educational experience for all in the classroom when you have an all-white class talking about affirmative action or racial profiling than when you have a racially diverse class. We've seen the devastating effects of limiting affirmative action in the public universities here in California. If Grutter is overruled, that's going to be experienced across the country. Fourth area that I want to talk about is the separation of church and state. In 1947, when the Supreme Court first said that the Establishment Clause of the First Amendment applies to state and local governments, all nine justices said that what the Establishment Clause is all about is creating a wall to separate church and state. In fact, all nine justices described to the metaphor coined by Thomas Jefferson that the Establishment Clause is meant to create a wall, high and impregnable, separating church and state. I deeply believe that such a wall is essential in our society. What it means is that our government will be secular, that all of us, whatever our religions or no religion, can feel that it's our government, and that we should have a robust protection of free exercise of religion in our lives, our churches, our synagogues, our mosques, our homes, our businesses, wherever we want, but our government will be secular. In recent years, there have been four justices on the court who have vehemently attacked the idea of a wall that separates church and state. In recent years, it was Chief Justice Rehnquist, joined by Justices Scalia, Kennedy, and Thomas. Just a few years ago, in 2005, I argued a case in the Supreme Court. There was a challenge to a Ten Commandments monument that sits directly between the Texas State Capitol and the Texas Supreme Court. It's right at the corner between them. And the monument is 6 feet high and 3.5 feet wide. And it has in big letters, "I am the Lord thy God." And I can tell you, as I prepared the brief in that case, as I stood before the justice in March of 2005, I knew that I had absolutely no chance of getting the votes of Rehnquist, Scalia, Kennedy, and Thomas. Because their view is that religious symbols on government property never violate the Establishment Clause. Their view that they've articulated in many instances is that the government violates the Establishment Clause only if it literally establishes a church or coerces religious participation. Now, here too, we can trace this back to the Reagan administration. The Reagan administration filed briefs in the Supreme Court urging that position. In fact, the Justice Department of the first President Bush, in a brief written by John Roberts, Deputy Solicitor General, took that position. The current Bush administration has taken that position, but there have only been four votes for that position until recently. If ever it gets a fifth vote, then very little will be found to violate the Establishment Clause. Under this view, any religious symbol of government property is permissible at any point in time. In fact, an oral argument in the case I mentioned, Justice Kennedy said to me, "Well, if your client doesn't like the monument, why doesn't he just avert his eyes?" And of course, by that notion, there could be a large cross atop any city hall and just say to somebody, "If you don't like it, just avert your eyes." Justice Scalia wrote an opinion in that case in which he took the position that we're a nation that is majority Judeo-Christian, so long as the symbols are Judeo-Christian, we can't really object. Justice Scalia has always said that we should be concerned about the rights of the majority who want religion in government. Of course, I've always thought the purpose of the Bill of Rights is to protect the minority. Now I think there are five votes on the Supreme Court to take that position. John Roberts seems to take that position based on writings that he did when he was in the Justice Department and other things that he said. We know that Justice Scalia, Kennedy, Thomas take that position. And if you look at Samuel Alito's opinions when he was a judge on the Third Circuit, this appears to reflect his views as well. Now, there hasn't been a Supreme Court case about this, but the area where I am most confident in predicting that the Roberts Court will radically change the law is in the obliteration of the wall that separates church and state. The fifth and final area that I want to talk about concerns war powers. specifically what's going on with regard to the war on terrorism. Here, too, I think you can trace what the Bush administration has done back to what occurred during the Reagan administration. During the Reagan administration, some key officials, and among them were some young lawyers, John Roberts and Samuel Alito in the Justice Department, came with an idea that they called unitary executive power. That all executive power has to be vested and controlled by the president, and that the ability of even the courts or Congress to limit it are greatly constrained. Now, we saw this with regard to something that people in this room would remember, the Iran-Contra controversy. If you remember, the Boland Amendment prohibited any federal funds from being used to aid the Contras in Nicaragua. And the whole selling of arms to Iran was done to try to circumvent the Boland Amendment. A dissenting report in the House Foreign Affairs Committee, which Dick Cheney played a key role in drafting, took the position that the Boland Amendment was unconstitutional, that the president as commander-in-chief should be able to direct where federal funds go when it comes to foreign policy, and that any attempt by Congress to limit it would be unconstitutional. Now, nobody paid a lot of attention because it was a minority report to a House report, but the outline of the Bush position with regard to foreign policy was all contained there. It's a view of executive power that can't be checked by the courts or by Congress. I've always thought that one of the most basic principles of constitutional law, checks and balances, that what one branch does should be able to be checked by another branch. That generally, to take any important action, two branches should have to be involved. But that's not the position of the Bush administration. For example, the authorization for warrantless electronic eavesdropping by the National Security Administration is in clear violation of a federal statute, the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act, and I also think clear violation of the Fourth Amendment. It's wiretapping, phone conversations, electronic communication of people in the United States without a warrant, as is required by the Fourth Amendment, and not complying with the procedures required by federal law. But the Bush administration has taken the position that the provisions of the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act are unconstitutional, that the Bush administration doesn't have to comply with the Fourth Amendment, that there's inherent presidential authority to tap phones. The federal district court declared this unconstitutional a year and a half ago. Last summer, the Federal Court of Appeals for the Sixth Circuit, 2-1, said that the case should be dismissed for lack of standing, that nobody could show that his or her conversations were intercepted, because the National Security Agency won't tell who they intercepted, so no one has standing to sue. And just last month, the Roberts Court denied cert in the case. I think the most outrageous things that the Bush administration has done in the name of executive power is claiming the authority to detain American citizens without complying with the Constitution, without meeting any of the elements of due process. We saw this most especially with regard to a man named Jose Padilla. He was apprehended at Chicago O'Hare Airport in May of 2002. His alleged crime at that time was planning to build and detonate a dirty bomb in the United States. Keep in mind that this is an American citizen apprehended in the United States, charged with a planned crime in the United States. Whatever rights the people are apprehended and held in foreign countries, that's not what this is about. The Bush administration took the position, so the case was about to go back to the Supreme Court and look like they lose, that they could hold Padilla indefinitely, even for the rest of his life as an enemy combatant, without having to provide any of the requirements of the Constitution. Padilla was held for several years without being given the requirements of the Fourth Amendment, a warrant approving his arrest, without a grand jury indictment required by the Fifth Amendment, without trial by jury of the Sixth Amendment. There's another man right now whose case is still in the Federal Court of Appeals, Fourth Circuit, man named Ali Omari. Now, he's a foreign national who's lawfully been in the United States for a long period of time. He was a student at Bradley University in Peoria, Illinois. In 2002, he was apprehended as an enemy combatant. He's still being held as an enemy combatant, even though he's lawful in the United States, even though provisions of the Constitution fully apply to him. And the government has taken the position they can hold him literally for the rest of his life without having to provide any form of due process. We could talk about those who are in Guantanamo. The government has taken the position that they have the authority to detain these individuals indefinitely, without habeas corpus. And the Bush administration was successful in getting Congress to pass a bill, the Military Commission Act of 2006, that says that these individuals shall not have access to federal courts via writ of habeas corpus. Whether that's constitutional is now before the Supreme Court and is likely to depend on Kennedy. What the Bush administration has claimed here is no less than the ability to suspend the Fourth, Fifth, and Sixth Amendments, no less than the ability to do this without judicial or legislative oversight. I cannot imagine anything that more strikes the heart of what our Constitution is about. As we look to the future, and I'll conclude with this, for those who share my values, I think the picture is bleak. I think that the 2008 presidential election is likely to determine whether the Supreme Court becomes more conservative or stays ideologically the same. It's not likely to make the court better when it comes to civil liberties and civil rights. The reason is, think about who's likely to retire between now and January 20th, 2013. John Paul Stevens will turn 88 years old on April 23rd of this year. Now, he's in good health. He's as sharp as ever. But I don't think it's realistic he's going to still be on the court in 2013. There are widely circulated rumors that David Souter wants to retire and go home to New Hampshire. And there's always rumors about Ruth Bader Ginsburg's health and whether or not she'll be able to remain on the court until 2013. Now look at the other side of the ledger. John Roberts is 52 years old. He remains on the court until he's 87. John Paul Stevens' current age, he'll be Chief Justice until the year 2042. Samuel Alito and Clarence Thomas have not yet had their 60th birthday. Antonin Scalia and Anthony Kennedy are each in their early 70s. So unlike the 2004 election, where who replaced Chief Justice Rehnquist and Justice O'Connor was going to shift the direction of the Supreme Court, determine its direction, this is going to either make the court much more conservative or keep it ideologically the same. These are bleak times for civil liberties and civil rights, and the Bush administration deserves a lot of the blame for that.
I'm not sure whether to stand or not. I think I'll sit. Professor Brenner and the colloquium for inviting me to speak. It's a real pleasure to come to UCLA, a sister campus, to see colleagues from other departments, particularly the law school. I think both Berkeley and UCLA and the law schools are really undergoing a rebirth these days. And I can't tell you how many times in our faculty meetings we ask, what is UCLA up to? Because they're becoming more competitive, is making us more competitive, and I think it's a great dynamic. We should, however, probably agree to gang up on UC Irvine. As you can tell, Erwin Chemerinsky really doesn't need to hire any other faculty members for his law school, because as you saw, he just delivered that entire address. I did not detect any ums or ahs.
Not one.
And he has, and this, those of you who know Erwin, this is not news, but he doesn't have a single note in front of him. So just in case you can't see that. So it's always, for me, intimidating to debate Erwin. The other thing I'd like, the person I'd like to recognize is Jen Mnookin, who 25 years ago, taught me how to write. She was my editor on the school on the college newspaper many, many years ago. So all the bad things I've done since then are her fault.
I claim no responsibility.
What is the problem? But it's a real pleasure. And I think like Erwin, I know that in the standard in the humanities and social sciences often is to read a prepared paper, which many of you might have thought Erwin had just done. But we agreed not to do that beforehand, so I'm going to speak in the law school tradition, which is more to speak from notes. First, I think one thing Erwin did is he talked more about the Roberts Court, I think, than the president. And so what I'd like to do is just talk a little bit at the beginning to provide more context about the relationship of presidents to the courts generally before talking to President Bush. And what I would say is, despite the changes that Erwin has described, and I agree with him on almost every point in terms of describing what the court has been doing, which is chipping away at, I think, the consensus that existed under the Warren Court and persisted into the Burger Court. We do live, it seems to me, under a regime of judicial supremacy, where the other branches generally accept and obey Supreme Court interpretations of the Constitution. And I think many people in this room, or most everybody in this room, think that's a desirable state of affairs. What I would like to say is that that is not a would be a description of the way presidents in the past and the courts have interacted. In fact, I would say many of our greatest presidents, or many of the people that are considered our greatest presidents in polls of social scientists and historians, are people who actually were quite aggressive in their efforts to either reject the court, pressure the court, manipulate it, or even just defy it. And I would say that none of those things, Irwin may have a different view, but I would say that none of those things has actually occurred under this administration or any of the administrations since Reagan. And I would agree with Irwin that a lot of this starts with the election in 1980. But let me just describe for you a few things that presidents have done with regard to the Supreme Court. So Thomas Jefferson, who many people rank as one of the top five presidents in American history, famously said that he was not bound by interpretations of the Supreme Court of the constitutionality of criminal legislation. I tend to think he was right on the actual point of issue, the Alien Sedition Act, which had made it a crime to criticize the government during wartime. The federal courts had upheld this under the First Amendment. And Jefferson said, as president, I don't have to have the same view as the courts on this issue, and so I refuse to prosecute anybody under this law. And I will go ahead and release from prison anyone who has been prosecuted under this law. I think that's quite a reasonable position on his part, but he went farther. He thought that the Federalist Party, the party of Washington and Hamilton, had burrowed into the courts and was going to fight a political rearguard action against the Jeffersonians from the judiciary. And so Jefferson and his allies proceeded to try to impeach members of the judiciary. The first judge they impeached had the, at least for the Jeffersonian, had the good fortune of being insane and a drunk. So he, I'm not sure if that gets you impeached from the federal bench today, but it did back then. But the second judge they impeached, Associate Justice Chase, was neither crazy nor drunk. He was being impeached because the Jefferson administration disagreed with his views on the Constitution. And if I remember correctly, his impeachment fell short by only a few votes. Not exactly a friendly view by Jefferson towards the judiciary. The next president I mentioned is Andrew Jackson, and I feel a little reticent about discussing Andrew Jackson because in our room here we have America's leading historian on Andrew Jackson, so I'm very careful about what I say. Daniel Howe is here, so I'm a little nervous about discussing Jackson, but let me go ahead and try. First, there's this famous case called Worcester versus Georgia, where the Supreme Court appeared to hold that the state of Georgia could not drive the Cherokee tribe out of the state off its lands in violation of a federal treaty. It is apocryphal, and Daniel tried his best to track down whether, in fact, Jackson, in fact, said this. But Jackson was reported to have said, well, and this was a decision rendered by the Marshall Court to prevent the ouster of the Cherokee tribe. Andrew Jackson was reported to have said, well, John Marshall has made his decision, now he can enforce it. And I think the record is clear that Jackson did almost nothing to prevent the state of Georgia from actually achieving its ends, which it did, with, unfortunately, a large loss of life. Another area, I think quite along lines of Jefferson, that Jackson pursued was his attitude towards the Second Bank of the United States, which he thought of as this great instrument of the established status quo trying to defeat his administration. The Supreme Court had already upheld, in one of the great cases that we teach in law school, McCulloch versus Maryland, that the bank was constitutional. Andrew Jackson vetoed legislation renewing the bank and said quite clearly, the judges have their own view and I have my view. And I'm vetoing the bank because I think it's unconstitutional. He also vetoed it because he didn't like banks. He would not have liked the Federal Reserve Bank, although he probably would have liked subprime mortgages. But Jackson's view as president was that he could veto legislation that the Supreme Court had already upheld as being constitutional. We could talk about Abraham Lincoln, who I think famously said with regard to the Dred Scott decision that he would only enforce the Dred Scott decision as to the exact parties in that case, as to Dred Scott himself. But because he disagreed with the Supreme Court, he would not follow the rule of Dred Scott in regard to any other case, unless the courts made him do it issue by issue. And then, of course, we know during the Civil War, Abraham Lincoln suspended the writ of habeas corpus unilaterally without congressional permission, which did not come for two more years. He detained, Erwin mentioned the two cases of an American citizen and a permanent resident. You know, Abraham Lincoln had detained 4,000 American citizens behind the lines without access to the courts. He even threatened to throw the entire Maryland legislature into military prison. And, most famously, he was ordered to release one of these detainees by the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court, Chief Justice Taney, the author of Dred Scott, and Abraham Lincoln refused. And I think that's the only clear case in our history where a president directly refused to obey a judicial order. Last president I'll close with, in talking about context, is Franklin Roosevelt. Franklin Roosevelt obviously received a lot of opposition from the courts to the New Deal. Roosevelt did not, as perhaps some of his great predecessors did, refuse to obey judicial orders. But, as many of you know, he tried to pack the court. He tried to double the size of the Supreme Court in order to change its judicial outcomes. He failed in that effort, but the Supreme Court actually did change direction and began to uphold the laws establishing the New Deal. As historians today still fight about whether the court packing plan produced this, what's called the switch in time that saved nine, but there's no doubt that Roosevelt, who we commonly consider a president on the order of Washington and Lincoln, had no difficulty trying to manipulate and even attack the court politically to try to, because he disagreed with his views. So take that context and then place, I co-agree with Erwin that take what's happened since 1980. I do think we sort of live in this political era where a lot of the terms of debate were set by the Reagan election for good or ill, whether you disagree with it or not. The thing is, all the presidents since then have, including President Clinton, have tried to appoint judges to the lower courts and the Supreme Court with whom they agree. And they've tried to appoint judges who share their judicial ideology. It's one of the reasons we have an election for a president, is because of that appointment power. And I think Erwin's main problem is not that presidents do that, that presidents are elected and they appoint judges with whom they agree. His problem is that he doesn't like the direction of the substantive direction of whether they're pro-civil liberties or against civil liberties that he would prefer. And that may be true or not, but then the problem one has is not really with the Bush administration or the Reagan administration or their judges, it's with the fact that one is not winning elections and not winning, putting into office politicians who can appoint the justices that one wants. Right? I could just as easily say, well, Clinton appointed Ruth Bader Ginsburg and Stephen Breyer, and they seem to agree, I think, with the general liberal consensus. Is that terrible? I don't think that's terrible. Clinton won the election, and he got to put in judges he agreed with. I think this is something that is hardwired into the Constitution. Just a side note, I think actually in some ways it goes back well before Reagan. I think Nixon is probably the first president who sort of openly campaigned on wanting to put into office law and order judges. He tried to do that when he became president. But President Carter also appointed judges who shared his views, I think. Those of us who live in California, the Ninth Circuit, I think, was famously expanded from 18 judges to 28 judges in the last year of Carter's presidency, and he filled those 10 seats with very young judges, many of whom are still on the Court of Appeals here, who are generally, I think it's fair to say, generally liberal. I would actually say that if the Bush administration or the Republican presidents in general had the goals that Erwin sets out, and I don't disagree that there are certainly people who have those goals, I don't think it's been as successful as he thinks. And I think this is inherently part of what I would think is the difficulty in using courts, at least if you're in the Republican administration, is using courts to create social change. Give more context to some of the decision areas that Erwin has gone through. I do think that Roberts and Alito make a difference. And I think Irwin's quite right. Roberts doesn't make as much of a difference, but Alito does because of the replacement of Justice O'Connor. But look at some of the issues. I'm not going to go through all of them in detail, but the abortion. I mean, Irwin's quite right. The Supreme Court has upheld legislative prohibition of partial birth abortion, which was passed by Congress. But I have a hard time. First of all, Casey and Roe versus Wade have not been overruled. The fundamental right to abortion still exists. And several justices who were appointed by Republican presidents voted to uphold Roe. And I personally have a hard time believing that even if John McCain wins in 2008, that you're going to see the Supreme Court overrule Roe versus Wade in the next 4 to 8 years. It would be the perfect way for the court to guarantee having it return to the maelstrom of partisan politics, which I don't think they really want to do right now. I mean, if you look at what the Roberts Court is likely to be up to, if you look at its cases, I think this year and last year, they seem to be more than anything a pro-business court. They seem to be issuing decisions that try to establish uniform standards so that it's easier for businesses, large corporations, to operate throughout the country without having to deal with state-by-state regulation, which is not necessarily something that legal conservatives may want. Another area where the court itself has not gone the way conservatives would have hoped is campaign finance, the McCain-Feingold bill, which places restrictions on donations to political campaigns, was upheld by the Supreme Court with several Republican appointees. Affirmative action, I think Irwin's quite right that the Louisville and Seattle cases place restrictions on desegregation decrees. They don't overturn the power of courts to engage in desegregation remedies. They try to place limits on what can be done. But the core government power to engage in affirmative action at all was upheld by the Supreme Court in the Grutter case involving colleges and universities. And again, Republican judges were part of the majorities that made that happen. There are other areas which Irwin didn't mention where I think this court and the end of the Rehnquist court could be very surprising for people who think of Republicans or the conservative legal Republicans as having a certain agenda. So this court upheld, removed theoretical limits on the Commerce Clause power. For example, those of you who follow this, my students follow intently, the question of the use of marijuana. Maybe you may know by California Initiative, California allowed the legality of marijuana for medical purposes. As you can imagine, there are many willing followers of the law in the city of Berkeley on this score. Federal government tried to prosecute under federal laws to prevent this from happening. Seemed to many people this would be an area where the Supreme Court would draw lines on the power of the national government, but in fact the Supreme Court did not. The Supreme Court has also acted in other areas, as I mentioned before, to expand rather than limit the reach of national power, all in areas where I think there's a general desire to establish uniform rules for companies and businesses and even the federal government to operate. Let me talk a bit about, at the end here, about the war on terrorism and Irwin's characterization of it. First, I'd say, again, I think it's worth looking at precedents in context. I don't think that this idea of the unitary executive power was the creation of Reagan, the Reagan administration, and Roberts, the proto-Roberts and proto-Alito. I think the phrase comes from Alexander Hamilton in the Federalist Papers, this idea that all the executive power that is given by the Constitution to the federal government is vested in the president because of the executive power vesting clause. And presidents historically, when they're confronted by war, have claimed and exercised executive power in ways that do conflict with congressional views. And I think the Reagan and the presidents after him have followed in that train. First, let me say that I don't think it's just Bush that has claimed that the commander-in-chief power cannot be restricted by Congress. Every president from Nixon on has claimed that the War Powers Resolution, which limits the use of force by presidents abroad to 60 days without further authorization is unconstitutional, including Presidents Carter and Clinton, and have in fact used force abroad in violation of the statute. Take some previous presidents, not to belabor the issue, but take President Lincoln. What was the Emancipation Proclamation? How many of you actually read it? The Emancipation Proclamation is the declaration of the Commander-in-Chief on his sole authority in the Constitution to release the slaves. And he only thought he could do it in the areas where the Commander-in-Chief power ran because it only applied to the South. It did not apply to the areas of the North in the Union that had slavery. Many people don't realize this, but the Emancipation Proclamation ran directly contrary to two statutes passed by Congress, which created a process on freeing slaves. They created a process where individual cases had to be brought in federal court to free an individual slave by showing that the owner was a rebel. And Lincoln swept that aside in the Emancipation Proclamation. I think many people would agree with that, with the result of what Lincoln did. The other president I'll just point to is President Roosevelt. President Roosevelt, in the years leading up to World War II, was constrained by the Neutrality Acts, which were designed to prevent the United States from getting into war. I think many scholars today agree that the actions President Roosevelt took to get us into World War II, which included, for example, attacking German submarines and then mischaracterizing to the public what he'd done. Many scholars, I think, today agree that what President Roosevelt did was inconsistent or outright violated congressional statutes in the Neutrality Acts. But again, I think many people think that what Roosevelt did was good for the country. And President Roosevelt certainly believed he was acting under his powers as Commander-in-Chief. So with that context, again, let's look at what the Bush administration has, in fact, done in the war on terrorism on the issues that Irwin has identified. First off, on the National Security Agency and its wiretapping program. First of all, every president from Woodrow Wilson through Jimmy Carter conducted warrantless surveillance for national security purposes of electronic communications. And in fact, when President Carter signed the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act in 1978, which I agree with Irwin, placed criminal sanctions on the government agents who used wiretaps without a warrant. But President Carter said that there still remained a presidential power to engage in those kinds of surveillance if done for national security purposes. Courts of appeals have handled this issue, especially one created specifically to hear cases about electronic surveillance, upheld the existence of this power, just based back in 2002. I don't think it's the case that the president is sort of running unchecked here. I think Congress has the full ability to prevent the president from doing this if they wanted to. They could cut off the funds for it. They could eliminate the program and facilities that are carrying out the surveillance. Instead, if you follow what's been going on, the president and Congress now agree on this type of surveillance. The only thing they're fighting about now is whether the telecommunications companies that carried this out in the past should have immunity from lawsuit. But aside from that provision, the President and Congress, are now in agreement and have been for some time about whether this surveillance should continue. The detention of U.S. citizens. I think Irwin's quite right. If you look at the detention of citizens in wartime when you don't provide them with the normal normal criminal justice provisions, you would think that the detention of Jose Padilla or Mr. Almari are in violation of the Bill of Rights. But there is a difference in the way the Bill of Rights apply against enemy prisoners of war and against civilians who are captured by law enforcement and are put on trial. I point to examples of World War II and the Civil War where Americans were detained by the government because they had joined up with the other side. And they weren't put on criminal trial for committing a crime. They were held until the war is over. I think the really hard question is not whether that power exists, but how long it goes on for. Because Irwin placed a lot of stress on the fact that the detentions would be indefinite. or would never end. And I think the thing that's different is not that the executive branch claims some power to detain people indefinitely. It's because the conflict itself, the war itself, and maybe the real problem is there are many people who don't think it's a war, but the war itself, it's hard to imagine when it's going to be over. And I think that's a hard legal question and a hard constitutional question that certainly reasonable minds could differ on. The Supreme Court and the courts have never told us when they define a war to be over. They've usually just looked to the President and Congress to make that decision. So let me close by saying, I think one reason that you see conflict over the Constitution in the last 8 years has not really been between the administration or the executive branch and the courts. They've really been between the President and Congress. And I don't think there's anything unusual about that. I don't think there's anything fundamentally wrong with having constitutional conflicts between the President and the Congress. And oftentimes, as Irwin pointed out, they have agreed and, in fact, overruled Supreme Court decisions in the war on terrorism area. I think the problem is this, is that having the courts play the role that Irwin likened to play, I think is rather unprecedented in wartime. There's no doubt that courts do intervene, have intervened in the past during war, but they've usually waited till the hostilities were over. They've usually waited until the war is done, and so any costs to having judicial intervention are not going to be realized because there's no longer any foreign threat. I think the thing that's actually unusual about this period over the last 8 years, and again, a period that's been led by Republican-appointed justices, has been the level to which the court has decided to intervene in the course of this war while hostilities are still going on. I think that's unusual and unprecedented. I would say it's not because the Bush administration has defied the courts or tried to manipulate it in the way previous presidents have. In fact, I think it's a reflection, and close with this, is a reflection of how much more powerful the courts and the Supreme Court have become in our society, and how much more deferential presidents of all stripes, including the current president, have become to the Supreme Court. Thank you very much.
William Douglas says, "Won't lose our freedoms all at once, but slowly and incrementally over time." The key question I ask you to think about is, are we better in terms of liberty and equality than we were when George Bush took office on January 20th, 2001? If the Roberts Court justices in their first couple of years made us better in terms of liberty and equality than we were before they took office? Let me go through John's points. First, John says that the Bush administration accepts judicial supremacy. I find the phrase judicial supremacy a loaded one. No one likes the idea of supremacy. I would simply defend what Spinkford said in Marbury versus Madison. And I'm quoting directly, it's the province and duty of the judicial department to say what the law is, to determine if executive or legislative actions are constitutional. Now, as I listen to John say the Bush administration likes judicial supremacy, I couldn't help but think that there's never been any president in history who benefited more from judicial supremacy than George W. Bush, because but for Bush versus Gore, he probably wouldn't have been president.
Yeah.
But I do disagree with John. I don't know of another president, maybe since the time of Abraham Lincoln, that is more disrespectful of the judicial process than the Bush administration. The claim of the ability to detain American citizens without judicial review, to me, is contemptuous of the court. When Jose Padilla's case was before the Supreme Court, Ruth Bader Ginsburg asked the then Deputy Solicitor General, Paul Clement, "Are you saying that he has no right to a hearing in any court?" His response was, "His only right is to answer the questions that are put to him by his interrogators." To me, that is openly contemptuous of the court's about. And John is right that Abraham Lincoln also took the position to detain people with an habeas corpus, but the Supreme Court declared that unconstitutional. Second, John said that all presidents want to shape the Supreme Court in their ideology. Of course he's right. And it's the prerogative of the president or Article II of the Constitution to nominate Supreme Court justices. But there's a subtlety here that John doesn't acknowledge. Presidents vary in terms of ideologically defined. More ideologically defined presidents are more likely to pick ideologically defined justices. Franklin Roosevelt was a very ideologically defined president, and he picked very ideologically defined justices. Ronald Reagan was a very ideologically defined president and tried to do the same. Dwight Eisenhower wasn't a particularly ideologically defined president, so he could pick Earl Warren to be Chief Justice. He could pick a Democrat, William Brennan, to be on the Supreme Court. Bill Clinton was not a particularly ideologically defined president. Stephen Breyer is not a liberal justice. Stephen Breyer was the fifth vote in Hamdi to uphold the ability to detain American citizens apprehended in foreign countries, Senate combatants. Stephen Breyer was the fifth vote to uphold random drug searches of students who participate in extracurricular activities. And as I know very painfully, Stephen Breyer was the fifth vote to uphold the constitutionality of the Texas Ten Commandments monument. If you look at the lower court nominations of Bill Clinton, they also weren't particularly liberal. We can talk, for example, on the Ninth Circuit of judges like Tallman and Graber and Silverman and Gould, who vote far more like Republican judges than like Democratic justices. That's because Bill Clinton wasn't a particularly liberal president. What's different is our last Republican presidents have been very ideologically defined. Reagan, Bush, and Bush may have picked judges and justices not from the middle or the moderate right, but from the far right. And here my blame goes to the United States Senate. I think the Senate did not fulfill its constitutional duty when it confirmed Clarence Thomas, so there were 48 votes against him, and I don't think they fulfilled their constitutional duty when they confirmed Samuel Alito. We could talk about whether Clarence Thomas was qualified to be on the Supreme Court or not. We could talk about whether or not he committed perjury before the Senate Judiciary Committee. But at the very least, I believe that Thomas's and Alito's ideology are so far out of the mainstream that the Senate should have rejected them. The Senate should have said the president should have picked people more in the middle. Unfortunately, though, there were enough votes for filibusters, there weren't filibusters, and these justices were confirmed and will be there for decades to come. The third major point John makes is that the Supreme Court, that conservatives haven't been as successful as I suggested with regard to changing constitutional law. I wish he was right. I think in this instance he's not. Let's take abortion, his first example. He says he doesn't think the Supreme Court's likely to overrule Roe v. Wade. I think there are four justices on the current court who will vote to overrule Roe v. Wade. Roberts, Scalia, Thomas, and Alito. Scalia and Thomas have said so in every case. Roberts wrote a brief to the Supreme Court urging the overruling of Roe v. Wade. And I challenge John or anyone to point to anything in Samuel Alito's records that suggests other than he'd be the vote to overrule Roe. I don't think Anthony Kennedy will vote to overrule, so I don't think there's five votes now. But I think if John McCain gets to pick a justice like Roberts or Alito, there will be five votes, and it will happen. But at the very least, I think John misses my point. There are now five justices on the court to allow almost any government regulation of abortion up to a complete ban on abortion. And the reality is that's going to make it much harder for women in this country to get safe legal abortions. His second example is campaign finance. And here's two, I think he's wrong. I think we're going to see, and we've already seen, a major change from the Roberts Court. In recent years, four justices, Chief Justice Rehnquist, Justice Scalia, Kennedy, and Thomas, have taken the position that all limits on campaign contributions are unconstitutional, that contributing money to a candidate is core political speech. If there's a fifth vote for that position, Roberts and Alito join Scalia, Kennedy, and Thomas, then any limits on contributions, local, state, or federal, will be unconstitutional. I think there may be five votes for that position. John pointed to the fact that the Supreme Court 5-4 upheld McCain-Feingold in a case called McConnell versus Federal Election Commission. That was 5-4 with O'Connor and Stevens writing the majority opinion, joined by Souter, Ginsburg, and Breyer. Just last June, in a case called Wisconsin Right to Life versus Federal Election Commission, the Supreme Court effectively overruled a key part of that decision. Now, the decision was only 3 years old. Why did the Supreme Court overrule it? Because Alito replaced O'Connor and cast the vote in that direction. They haven't dramatically changed the law yet, but I think Wisconsin Right to Life suggests there are five votes who are going to dramatically change the law with regard to campaign finance. In terms of affirmative action, of course, John and I agree that Grutter versus Bollinger is still the law. But I think the Supreme Court's decision and parents involved in community schools leaves no doubt where Chief Justice Roberts and Justice Alito will be. And given that Justice Kennedy has never voted to uphold an affirmative action program in any area, given that Justice Thomas has never done so, I fear there are five votes to overrule Grutter. At the very least, the court made it much harder to achieve school desegregation. Finally, in this area, John talked about limits on the Commerce Clause. I think when constitutional historians look back at the Rehnquist Court, they will say its greatest change in constitutional law was in the name of protecting states' rights. The court limited the scope of Congress's commerce power. The court dramatically limited Congress's ability to protect civil rights and constitutional rights when acting in Section 5 of the 14th Amendment. The court revised the 10th Amendment as a limit on federal power. The court enormously expanded the scope of sovereign immunity. There have not yet been decisions about this from the Roberts Court. The marijuana case he mentioned was from the end of the Rehnquist Court. And we can talk about why I don't think that's reflected where the Supreme Court will be. When John Roberts was a judge on the D.C. Circuit, he wrote an opinion that said that he believed the Endangered Species Act was unconstitutional as exceeding the scope of Congress's commerce power. When Samuel Alito was a judge on the Third Circuit, he wrote a dissenting opinion saying that the federal law prohibiting assault rifles was unconstitutional as exceeding the scope of Congress's power. But the only judge in the country wrote an opinion saying that. I believe in the years ahead we're going to see a dramatic limit in federal power, especially to advance civil liberties and civil rights, in the name of states' rights. The fourth and final area that John wants to talk about concerns the war on terrorism. He makes a few points here. He said other presidents have claimed broad executive authority as well. Of course, he's right about that, but I don't believe that any president, maybe Lincoln during the Civil War, has made the kind of claims of unilateral authority to violate international law, the Constitution, and federal statutes that this president has made, and made time and again. I don't know of any other president who's shown the disrespect of the judicial process that this president has. John says other presidents have also authorized warrantless electronic eavesdropping. I think the question is, does it violate the Fourth Amendment to tap someone's phone or intercept their email without a warrant? Does the president have the authority to violate the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act that makes it a federal crime to do this without judicial approval? To my knowledge, other presidents didn't blatantly violate the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act. And if the president can suspend the Fourth Amendment in the name of national security, why not the First Amendment? Dick, why can't the president call off elections in the name of national security? And if John's going to say there's something different about the Fourth Amendment, does that mean in the name of national security the president can search your or my house, or your purse, or your pocket, just in the name of national security? Because if the president can violate the Fourth Amendment and ignore the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act for national security, why not physical searches as well? Now, it's a tension, the largest area of disagreement between John and me. He says, I'm going to quote him verbatim. He said, the Bill of Rights applies differently to prisoners of war. Well, if we're talking about prisoners of war, then there's international law, the Geneva Accords that apply, and the Bush administration has refused to follow that law either. But I think, at the very least, when it comes to an American citizen or a person lawfully in the United States, apprehended in the United States, the Bill of Rights applies. When the framers wanted to have exceptions, they put them in the Constitution. There is an exception to the grand jury clause in the Constitution. There's an exception to habeas corpus. But there's no authority of the president to detain individuals short or long term when you're talking about not complying with the Fourth, Fifth, and Sixth Amendments. No. Whether it's the nature of the conflict or the nature of the administration that causes indefinite detention, when you're talking about somebody like Omari or the people in Guantanamo who have now been held for 6 years with no prospect of release, 6 years of their lives lost without any prospect of release, to me that's inconsistent with those fundamental notions of human rights. John says that the kind of judicial review I want is unprecedented in wartime. I can point to counterexamples where courts have stood up to the administration in wartime. Depending on Papers case, for example. But I think what John's calling for here is for us to repeat the worst instances of American history. I think the parts of American history we should be most ashamed of are the instances where courts deferred to the administration and Congress in times of war. I think here of the laws that were passed during World War I, 1917 and 1918, that essentially made it a crime for people to criticize the government and the draft. And people going to prison for long periods of time just for arguing that the draft was unconstitutional. Or I think of the Korematsu case here, where the Supreme Court upheld the evacuation of 110,000 Japanese Americans, aliens and citizens, adults and children, 70,000 war citizens, from their lifelong homes. And one of the greatest embarrassments in constitutional laws that the Supreme Court didn't declare that unconstitutional. I think of the McCarthy era, where the Supreme Court upheld convictions for no more than the tamest and mild form of speech. I think we shouldn't follow that precedent. I think we should want a court that enforces the Constitution, even in times of crisis. let me just conclude with the words. Let me conclude with the words. I'll conclude with the words by the late Justice Louis Brandeis. He said that the greatest threat to liberty will come from people who claim to be acting for beneficial purposes. He said, people born to freedom know to resist the tyranny of despots. He said, the insidious threat to freedom will come from well-meaning people in zeal with little understanding what the Constitution is about. Now, Brandeis never knew Alberto Gonzalez or Donald Rumsfeld, but he couldn't have said better words if he did.